I'm Kevin Kelly. This is Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. On the program today, we have first a feature on something called the Soul Miners Children's Theater Company of Champaign-Urbana. They're in the midst of performances of a musical for children called Horton the Elephant. And Helen Katz is here to talk about that. And then we'll be having later some conversation and some live music for dancing in advance of the annual Playford Ball put on by the Central Illinois English Country Dancers. That's our show today. Hope you'll stay tuned to FM 90.9. Something just a little bit different for you, a take on Vivaldi's Spring Concerto from his Four Seasons Violins Concertos, from a disc called Snoopy's Classical Classics on Toys, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I thought that might be a at least semi-reasonable introduction to our first segment on the show today, which is about Soul Miners Children's Theater Company of Champaign-Urbana. Building character on stage, they say, and they're doing that through the means of theater arts and performance. And the piece that they're working on and have actually done a few performances already and have a couple of left this weekend is a musical called Horton the Elephant. And here to talk about that is one of the two founders of the company, Helen Katz. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Why Soul Miners, the name, and then why Soul Miners, the company? Where'd the idea come from?
Well, I'll tell you about the name. It actually comes from a quotation from the Baha'i writings, from Baha'u'llah. It's very short. Let me just read it real quick. He said, "Regard man as a mine, rich in gems of inestimable value. Education can, alone, cause it to reveal its treasures and enable mankind to benefit therefrom." And so that's the philosophy. The philosophy is that each one of us is born noble. We have great things to give to humanity. We have great qualities in ourselves, and it's like digging them out of a coal mine. You know, that's what education is uncovering those qualities and virtues. And that our purpose overall is to be of benefit to other people, to be a benefit to humanity. So with that underpinning in mind, the idea behind Soul Miners, and we didn't make this up, we borrowed this from a group in New York that we're licensing with that has been doing this for several years, like about 10 years, is to combine a kind of virtues, moral education that a lot of Baha'is are doing all over the world in various ways with theater education, professional theater education, because we hire people who are professional in the field. And use theater, as you said, as a means, because it's an excellent means. It's also a means to an end in itself, you know, to help kids think about those things about themselves and learn those kinds of virtues. And we try to infuse that into the way they work with each other, the way they work with us, the way we work with them, how we resolve conflicts, anything that's going on in the whole experience. And in the show itself, we've identified certain virtues that they've studied during the whole term that we've been doing this, and we talk to the audience about that at the end, and that's kind of fun because then we get audience feedback. Like one of the virtues is responsibility, and we'll say, "Where did you see that in the show?" And someone will come up with, "Oh, I saw it here or there." And sometimes they say the things that we assume because we've already talked about it, and sometimes they come up with something entirely new that we hadn't thought of.
These are questions you're putting to the audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to make sure they're paying attention.
No, it's just kind of it's because this isn't just a theater project. It's a theater project slash character education, or I still haven't found quite the right overall term I want to use for this. But anyway, and that's the only reason we started it. There's lots of theater companies already running around this town. You don't really need another one necessarily. But we felt that this would, you know, fulfill a new purpose. And so we wanted to have the show be not just the show, but also have some element of the other experience the kids had this whole term with it.
For those who may not be familiar with the Baha'i faith or with who Baha'u'llah was, why don't you give us a little bit of background of that and how that's a little more about how that's informed this particular project.
Okay. Well, Baha'u'llah is, we believe, the teacher of God for today, and that his main teaching is unity, that we're now at the stage of developing maturity where we will be able to begin to have a united world. We're going to have to go through some stuff to get there, but that we're on the way. And the way, and that's extremely short, but the main purpose of how that relates to this is that my daughter and I are Baha'is, and so our goals in life, our beliefs and so on are all, you know, come from that. And we wanted to do, and we also are both actors and writers, have done some professional work together and separately, and just wanted to use the very powerful means of theater to help advance moral, spiritual character progress in children. And when we started this, we knew it was a long-term thing. We started with, you know, like 11 kids and 3 months or so and of a term, you know, very short. But we knew that was just the beginning and that it was just our little tryout thing and we're going to learn what we're doing and keep going. So we expect to be doing this for quite a long time. We know from the experience they've had in New York and some other places that spun off of that, that it can become a very powerful influence in neighborhoods and communities. And so that's what we're doing.
The New York experience is also comes out of the Baha'i?
Yeah, partly, because the woman who originally thought it all up is Baha'i. She has a lot of people she's working with who aren't Baha'i, just like we do. Our parents, the parents involved in this are not all Baha'is. They're about half and half right now, which is probably the highest percentage we'll ever have, because we talked about this. We planned this for so many months and talked about it for so long that several Baha'i parents were just like waiting. Yes, I want to do it. So they were automatically in. But as we go on, we're going to have a much higher percentage of people from all different backgrounds, which is what we want. It's very much an interfaith kind of experience. And when we teach virtues like kindness, responsibility, courtesy, et cetera, we always find quotations to help demonstrate that from all different religions and inspirational writers. And, you know, we don't. It's not just Baha'i.
Yeah, my experience of the Baha'i faith is exceedingly minimal. I did visit the temple in, is it Wilmette?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Wilmette. Just north of Evanston, where I used to live. My only real recollection is not only the idea of unity, but I remember looking around the temple there and seeing quotations and scripture readings from all kinds, all different religions.
Right.
I mean, really every religion I'd ever heard of.
Right.
Is it accurate to call the Baha'i faith itself a religion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. What Baha'u'llah said is that there's one God, and God gives us, and there's one religion, and he gives it to us in stages, just the way we learn just about anything in life is in stages. And the different teachers, Muhammad, Jesus, Moses, Buddha, so on, are each represent a new stage in mankind's maturity, and there's no conflict between them. The conflict between the followers, you know, people have said, this is the only one, whatever, you know, and that causes conflict. But he said there was no conflict between them, and they were each there to bring us to the next stage of our understanding of God and ourselves and, you know, so on.
Conflict is more between the people trying to interpret the things that their teachers said in the first place.
Yeah, and trying to make each one final, I guess.
Yeah.
And he was very clear that this is not final. There will always be another one, at least as long as we're on this planet. And I'm kind of assuming that goes to other planets, too, but that's just, I don't know about that.
Well, we don't really know. I mean, that's the
no,
thing
we
that's,
don't.
That we don't know. So the progress of creating this production, what was the process? How long have the kids been working on the general teachings leading up to the performance? Has it all been integrated with
that's
Horton
a good
the Elephant?
I was thinking about that. Actually, it's when they started on February 20th, we knew what show we wanted to do, but we were still trying to get organized as to how we were going to do it. We'll know better next time more about how to do all this, but we were learning. And rather than dive right into the show, we wanted to have a little time to get to know the teachers, and teachers get to know them, and so on. And so for about the first maybe 3 or 4 weeks, they worked on theater games and theater general theater arts instruction with the teachers. And then they started working on the actual show. And at first it was just like learning songs, and then it was assigning parts. And the teachers did an excellent job. I'm impressed because it takes a lot of patience to work with kids. You know, I've directed shows with adults, but I've watched them work with the kids, and it's just, I'm glad it's them because it's tough. But they've done a wonderful job. And so in terms of actual rehearsal time, meeting once a week since about early to mid-March, they haven't really had a lot of rehearsal time for what they've accomplished. It's pretty impressive.
Have they, how have they taken to sort of the values instruction and, well, on its own, have they been aware the whole time that this is a vehicle for that, or are they more aware of the fun of it and hopefully they're absorbing the values instruction?
No, they're definitely aware, because every Saturday afternoon, the first thing we do is spend an hour having a virtues class. I'm calling that a virtues class now. I don't know. It might change form a little bit next time. But a class that focuses on spiritual and moral growth and development. And what we did in this term is we picked out 12 qualities or virtues from the show and used one for each class, so that each class they would study that one in various ways and make pictures and talk about it and have stories and so on.
And why did you pick? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, then they would go on. Then we have a little break, and then they go on and start working on the actual theater. So it was all integrated together.
And why did you pick Horton the Elephant?
Oh, my goodness. It was totally a practical thing. We have all these possibilities because we're able to use the material that they've developed in New York. And for our first age group, because of some specific kids, including my grandson, that we knew wanted to be in it, we had to go with an age spread from 6 to 10, which is a little bit broader than we would usually do. And so we just looked at everything and said, okay, that'll work for age 6 to 10. We actually have one girl who's 12 in it because she's been an assistant, and they gave her some lines. She's doing really well. So that's how we picked it. It was a good show, but they have a whole catalog of other things too. And we just kind of went through and said, okay, this one is good for this age group, and so that's what we went with.
So 6 to 10 is the age group for the whole...
this time.
But you're planning to expand into
next
older
time.
Kids?
Now that we've done this once and we know we can do it, this was like a scary project. Next time we're going to have two classes, and we're planning on ages 5 to 8 and 9 to 12.
But not expanding too much older so far, maybe later.
Not yet. We don't know how it'll grow. You know, things tend to grow on their own and tell you what they want to do and the other way around, so we'll find out.
So we're talking with Helen Katz of Soul Miners Children's Theater Company of Champaign-Urbana. The show is called Horton the Elephant, and there are two remaining performances at King's School in Urbana, Saturday at 7 in the evening, and then on Sunday at the Baha'i Center on East Green Street in Urbana, and I confess I don't even know where that is. I'm going to have to go have a look. It's 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon.
You know, I should have put this on all the flyers. I don't know why I didn't, because I know better. People often don't realize that Green Street goes east of Vine in Urbana. They get as far as Lincoln Square Village, and they think, uh-oh, I've
green
lost
is
green.
Done. Yeah.
But actually, if you just get around the village and you keep going, it's about 4 or 5 blocks. I mean, it keeps going all the way to Cottage Grove. But the Baha'i Center is about 4 or 5 blocks past Vine.
Yeah, because Lincoln Square is in the way.
Yes, it's in the way.
It stops the progress of the street. Well, you brought along a recording of this, actually, of one of the performances.
Yeah, the first one.
So the qualifier here is it is not a professionally done recording,
nope.
And it's right in the middle of the audience.
Right. We were at the Mennonite Church, and Chris had to stand basically in the aisle between pews.
So this is just a tiny, it's about a minute segment from Horton the Elephant. And from Soul Miners, and these are kids 6 to 10 years old, and you're hearing them on Live and Local.
Thank you.
And that's just a little segment from Horton the Elephant. What were they saying? It sounded like 10 cents.
10 cents a peak.
A peak.
Yeah, because what happens in the story is that there is a bird named Maisie who just doesn't want to sit on her nest and hatch her egg. She just doesn't want to bother. And she ends up talking nice Horton into doing it for her. And he manages to climb up on this tree and sit on her egg without breaking it. This is from a Dr. Seuss story. And he won't leave no matter what. The part that I don't think quite got finished that Jay said there in that in those lines is he keeps saying over and over, I meant what I said and I said what I meant, and elephant's faithful 100%. And so no matter what happens, he stays on that egg and all sorts of things happen to him, including he gets put into a circus. And that's what that song's about, people coming up and being charged 10 cents a peek to look at him and laugh.
Look at him, yeah. I remember that story very well. There's a couple of Horton the Elephant stories, aren't there, of Dr.
Yeah,
Seuss?
I think there are.
And this was the one called, what was the original story called?
I think the original story is Horton Hatches.
Horton Hatches, yeah, there, yeah.
I kind of goofed and thought that was the name of the show at first, so some of our publicity has that, and then I found out I was wrong.
Oh, I've seen somebody listed it some other way, too, in one of the newspapers.
Yeah, that was my fault, because halfway through the process, I found out, uh-oh, we're not supposed to be using that title, because we have a licensing thing we're setting up with the New York group, so I learned.
Horton the Elephant is the name of the musical put on by Soul Miners Children's Theater Company, which was founded by Helen Katz and your daughter,
Heidi Baker.
Heidi Baker, and along with a number of teachers involved. It comes out of the Baha'i Church here in Champaign-Urbana. Mm-hmm. Or is it, and it really comes out of you guys who happen to be Baha'i.
That's what it really amounts to. It's individual initiative. And we, because we're doing it at the Baha'i Center and we needed some support to help us get going, that's where we got a lot of our support and a lot of our, well, I guess support's the best word, I don't know, you know, and the building to use and everything. But it is not a Baha'i project. The parents who were involved, one of the interesting things about this whole project, which I'm really happy about, is that, and again, we're following the New York model, is that we really require parents to be involved. It's not just to kind of drop off your kid and come back later. And so everybody helped out, not every week, but in certain weeks. You know, everyone volunteered for certain weeks. And when it came time for the show, the parents just jumped in with both feet, and they have been wonderful. And we have a mix of parents. We have one family that's Muslim, one family that's Jewish, you know, others that are Christian, a few that are Baha'i. So we're having a really good mix racially and religiously, and I think that'll just get to be more and more like that in the future as we get more well-known.
For more information, you can go to soulminers.org. And the performance is, again, Saturday, 7 o'clock at King's School on Fairview in Urbana, and Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Baha'i Center on East Green, that's east of Vine Street, also in Urbana. Helen Katz, thanks for joining us on Live and Local.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we have a conversation about the Playford Ball put on by the Central Illinois English Country Dancers, and we'll also have the some performances as part of that conversation that you can dance to if you like. It's Live and Local. Are the Mean Lids coming from last September's Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival. There will be another one this coming September. listening to them here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our program today is made possible with support from Sweeney Brothers Carpet and Rug Gallery of Bloomington, an authorized Karistan broadloom and rug dealer at 11 Westport Court on Bloomington's east side. Sweeney Brothers, where the beauty of a room starts with the floor. My guests for this portion of Live and Local are all participants in the upcoming Playford Ball, the 15th annual such ball by the Central Illinois English Country Dancers in Urbana. It's going to be at the Illini Student Union on the University of Illinois campus. And we got to talk about this about a year ago, right at this time, as this is, of course, an annual event. Jonathan Sevier is with us, also John Hansen, to tell us a bit about the event and also remind us, for those who have heard them describe it before and also new information for others, just who are the Central Illinois English Country Dancers. And we have three members of the group that commonly plays for this ball, the Flatland Consort, Kelly McQueen, Tom Anderson, and Richard Engelbrecht Wiggins. So thanks to all of you for coming in on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Jonathan.
Yes.
since you have sort of been chief spokesman, at least when I've had you guys on before, the Central Illinois English Country Dancers, quick overview for those who haven't heard.
Well, we are a group that does English country dancing, of course, and we've been around here locally about 15 years, and we hold dances approximately monthly, and then twice a year we'll have a ball, because it seems like an appropriate thing to do. So we usually have a Christmas ball in December and then Playford ball in late May or early June.
Who was Playford?
John Playford was a book publisher in London in the mid-1600s, and he, in 1651, published a book called The English Country Dance Master, or The English Dancing Master, something along those lines.
I think it was English Dancing Master.
Yeah. And it was the first time somebody had taken instructions for dances, the figures and the music, and put them together in a book. One handy book that you could take home and do your own dances with, sort of. And it became very popular, sold a lot of copies, and there were many, many editions for the next 100 years. He and his sons and grandsons continued to publish, further editions of the book.
He wasn't himself a composer, though.
No, as far as we know, he didn't actually write any dances. He was just an editor who put a bunch of things together and that other people of unknown origin had written and sort of put it all together in book form.
Although a lot of these dances are credited, the composers are credited, aren't they? Or mostly not.
Some of them, like the tune they were just playing for the warm-up, Hole in the Wall here, it says it's based on Purcell. It's a tune by Purcell. And there are several like that. But most of them, there's no real good indication of who wrote the dance or who wrote the tune. Some of them are based on, like, drinking songs that were popular at the time.
Well, that probably explains why I have definitely seen certain number of pieces attributed to Playford as composer, because they probably saw it was in his book,
right.
and then
there's
stuck his name
that
on it.
They know other names, so they
might as well blame him.
Yeah,
yeah. Country dance. What does that mean? What does the country part mean?
Well, to some degree, it's an affectation in that the people who were actually doing these dances lived in the city for the most part, but it was at least one of the things that people think is the case, is that they were city folk doing dances that they thought were of the sort that maybe the country folk might be doing.
That reminds me of that song from Camelot, What Do the Simple Folk Do?
Exactly, right. And it's very much like that. It became a very popular activity before Playford. Obviously, there was a market for his book, so it was a popular activity prior to his publishing the book in 1651, but we don't have any real record of it until that time. But the impression I get is that it was sort of people who were, society in the city wanted to sort of pretend that they were country folk or do things that were country related.
So whatever. This is not necessarily among the aristocracy, or was it?
I think it was largely the dances that we do. The people who bought the books were probably middle class, upper middle class, and at least you think of the being the dances being done in the big halls and the big castles and things like that.
So these are not manor houses. Dances you would be doing outside.
Probably not.
Because that's
although some of, I mean, who knows? Some of them may indeed have originated in the country and been done by on the village green someplace and then gotten, you know, codified into something that people did in the cities. But a lot of them, I suspect, were written specifically to be done in dance halls in the, you know, at the ball at so and so's house. And you can, a lot of the names, there's one that we do have done in the past called Hunsdon House, and it's named for a big castle someplace. And then there's the Duke of Kent's Waltz is one that we do. So something written for somebody who was famous and wealthy, probably.
This is definitely something that was a respectable thing to do, this sort of dancing.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that there were some that maybe wasn't.
Probably, but...
But you don't do anything.
Actually, to be well-educated, you should know these dances.
That's true,
and
yeah.
You would take dance instruction, and it would be quite the embarrassment if a tune started and you didn't know what the dance was.
And the thing is that the people in those days, they didn't have TV. They didn't have a lot of the things that we have to occupy our time these days. So they learned the dances. There were dancing masters who went around and taught the dances. And if you were anybody and wanted to be in high society, or were or wanted to be, you would learn the dances so that at the ball you could do them without any prompting. They might announce what the dance was going to be, and then you'd line up and do it because you all knew it.
And of course, as Jonathan may have said earlier, there's one tune with one dance.
Right.
They're paired up very specifically. So
yes.
If the musicians played a few bars, you should know
what
the dance
know what
is.
It was, yeah.
And line up or form up and be ready to go.
And in fact, there's talking about people learning to the dances to fit into society. There's a set of dances that are known as the dances of the Inns of Court. The Inns of Court were, they're referring to buildings, but it was sort of a group of, I don't know if you want to call it a group of people or whatever. It's where young men, of course, went to learn to be lawyers in London. The inns were around the court. And they took classes on the law and things like that, but they also took classes in etiquette and dance and other things that if you were going to be a lawyer, you had to be a gentleman, and therefore you had to know how to do certain things, and one of those things was dancing. And these dances are from the late 1500s, and they were found in the notebooks of people who had been students. So, you know, on one page there'd be, you know, class about the, you know, some aspect of the law, and then on the next page there's a dance written down that they had to learn how to do in order to be able to fit into society.
And so is that still true for your group, that one tune, one different, one dance?
As a rule, yes, that's true. Nearly all the dances that we do have their own tune that goes with them.
Well, since we have three of the members of the Flatland Concert here to play for us, why don't we hear one of those tunes?
After this, maybe we can... I'd like to hear your research on how authentic are the dances as portrayed in the Jane Austen movies.
Oh.
how they are portrayed as English country dances. how do you think they look compared to what actually happened?
Well, okay, that's a whole different issue.
So there's your assignment, Jonathan. You can run out and research it while they play the music. What's the tune we're going to hear?
This piece is called Newcastle, another one that probably took place in a castle somewhere along the way.
So that was a fairly short tune. Is that something you would just keep repeating during the duration of the dance, or is that the typical length and then you're done with the dance?
We went through it two times, and there are three sections, each of which were repeated. No, two sections for this one that were repeated.
Mm-hmm. So in the actual dance on Saturday, you might play it longer?
No, three times.
This one is a... We have some dances where it's the same little pattern repeats over and over and again many, many times. And the tune is repeated over and over again, a dozen times or so.
Meaning the dance pattern is repeated.
The dance pattern and the tune go together, and they're of the same length. And
so it can be repeated until the caller decides to cut it off.
But then there are other ones where there's a specific series of things that happen, and then it's done. And this is one that is like that, where it's three times through the tune and three times through the tune, and you're doing various things during that time, and then it's done. Usually when it's a short dance like that, we'll do it again, but it doesn't go on and on and on forever.
And we heard three members of the Flatland Consort. Kelly McQueen played the fiddle, Tom Anderson playing keyboard, and Richard Engelbrecht Wiggins, good grief, playing the cello. And who's missing from the consort? It's not just three of you in the whole group.
We have a fiddler who's from Normal, Bloomington Normal, and he's probably the first of the group that got together, got us organized some 15, 16 years ago.
A founding member.
A founding member, yes. In fact, we used to dance and play at his home in Normal. That was the first setting our dances and what have you. And it was he playing the fiddle, I played recorder, and we had a guest guitarist from that area, and that was the original band. And then we moved here, and we have two recorder players that are not here with us today. And sometimes we have a harpist, and sometimes we have a guitar player that plays for the balls only. Twice a year, she plays for the balls. So,
when you say when it plays for the balls only, as opposed to what, the monthly dances?
The monthly dances, yeah.
So, is it usually you guys that play for this consort that plays for those monthly dances, or don't you sometimes have other groups that have come in?
We have occasionally had other groups, yes, but the Flatland Consort plays 90-some-odd percent of the. Yeah. Dances, both the monthly and the balls.
We're the house band.
The house band, right, yes.
Well, who was what was the event we were talking about last time you guys were here?
Well, a year ago, perhaps, if this is what
no,
you're
more
thinking.
Recently than that.
Oh, more recently.
March Fest.
The March Fest?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, well, that was
our... that would included some international folk dance,
right.
some contra, and then the English ball was in the evening. And actually, that's a third ball that we have during during the
year. That's a special event, and in that case, we did have an out of town band that was coming here to play.
Pigtown Alley, was
right?
It? Yes. And so that's a special ball that is in joint effort with the other dance groups. And then the summer, the Playford Ball, and then the Christmas Ball is pretty much strictly the English groups.
Right.
Even though there's a lot of cross-dancing between the international people, the Contras, and the English country dancers. But there are a lot of people also that focus on one or more of those dance styles and don't get into the others too much.
Now, you said English groups.
Well, the English group, as opposed to, like a lot of people dance contra, but not English. There are a lot of us that, like Jonathan and I, that will do the contra and the English. And then some of the international folk dancers will do one or the other or all three. So one English group.
And how did you three instrumentalists come to this particular style of playing?
Kelly was recruited about a year ago, year and a half ago, I guess.
Yeah, I studied music history at the University of Illinois, so this type of music really appeals to me from a historical context, and it's just fun to play.
But you play, you're doing some teaching at the Community Center for the Arts,
right? That's right. I teach private viola and violin lessons there.
And are you involved with the Bodacious String Band?
I have been in the past, yeah.
And they do a variety of, in fact, your school teaches kind of a variety of different types
absolutely.
Of music, not just straight classical.
Right. They kind of tend towards the old-time style of fiddle playing.
The Bodacious Group?
The Bodacious Group, yeah, just a little bit. But they do fiddle music from around the world, too. And this stuff, I've been trying to teach some of my students these songs since they're... I think they're wonderful, and they're one I'm playing a lot lately. But my students are like, these are too hard. They're in weird keys, or they're in weird time signatures. And it's similar enough to our own folk traditions that we can kind of recognize it. But it's also different enough from the historical context that it's a little bit odd.
Because I would have guessed it would have been relatively easy for younger students to play.
Yeah. Some of them, there's just a little bit too bizarre for some people to get a hold of.
And how much is that stylistic difference?
Probably most of it, or mostly just transcription, how it's written down. So instead of having a 4-4 tune, you'll have it in 12-8, was that? Yeah, so instead of having triplets in 4-4, you'll have it in 12-8, and it's just strange to look at.
Yeah, for kids who aren't used to looking at compound meters.
Right.
Yeah. We have a lot of stuff in 3-2, as a matter of fact, which is, we don't always know what to do with it, but it's something that you don't see very often.
Tom, what's your background?
It's not music, as is pretty clear. I guess I started playing recorder with the group, and then but we needed someone to keep a rhythm going, because we seldom use percussion, drums and things like that. So the keyboard is the main percussionist and sort of keeps the beat even and looks at the dancers to see if it's too fast or too slow, or looks at the callers, the ones who are calling the dancers, and they'll give us a little up sign, up the tempo some or down the tempo some or cut, we got to start again. Because you get 70 dancers going, and if it's not right, that everything's not right, people start stumbling over one another or just standing there waiting for things to happen. And so you really have to start and stop again, because the band very much has to be in consort with the callers and with the dancers. The whole hall has to feel good as it moves along with the music and the dance. And when that happens, and the caller can really stop calling, and watch the dancers, and they're moving to the music. You don't have anybody talking. You just sort of have it moving along, and that's really, really quite beautiful.
Have you done dancing yourself?
Yes. Right now I've got hip problems, and I can't dance, but I love to dance. And contra dancing is where I started dancing, and I'm a contra dance caller. But I also love English country dancing. And
so when you when your hips are working okay, do you dance while you play, or do you just abandon the keyboard and go join them?
Strapping this thing to my shoulders and dancing with it. I guess Red Green and Harold on Red Green used to strap a thing to his to his shoulder and play it. So maybe that's something to look forward to.
We sometimes take turns if one of us really wants to dance the dance.
Yeah, yeah.
Richard, what about you? How did you come around to?
Well, music has been a lifelong hobby, but I got into this form of music sort of by accident. I had been playing cello 5 or 6 years, and my daughter had been playing violin about the same amount of time, and had sort of lost interest, and I thought that maybe a new style of music would freshen your interest. So we signed up for an adult, Urbana Adult Ed class in fiddling with Kathleen Everingham. And she accommodated the cello very nicely, writing some music for it, some arrangements for it. And after 2 semesters of that, I was hooked, and my daughter gave up the violin. And she, I think, introduced me to the group, and they thought adding a cello to the group would be something nice. And they put up with me for about 6 years now, 5 years, and I've enjoyed it.
And you've got what listeners can't see, of course, since this is a radio program, is you have an unusual cello in two ways. One is that it's not made of wood, and the other is that it's got an extra string. You want to describe that for our folks, and why is it? Why are both of these things true?
This is a Lewis and Clark cello out of Boston. They make carbon fiber cellos, and I think it's because Louis, I believe he's a principal cellist of the Boston Pops, and he wanted a durable cello, so he had one made out of carbon fiber. And some years ago, somebody approached him wanting a 5-string cello because they wanted to record one of the Bach cello suites, which was one of them was written for 5-string cello. That deal fell through, but he mentioned he could produce a 5-string. And the nice thing about a 5-string cello, by adding the E string at the top end of the cello, the top 4 strings are now an octave below the violin, so I can take violin music, just transpose it down an octave without going into any of the fancy positions I don't know how to play. And yet I still have a low C string, so I can play it as a cello. So it's a combination of what would you call a violin is an octave down, not an octave violin. But an octave and a violin and an octave down together with the C string of the cello, so I have the 5 strings that cover that range.
And is this the only cello you've had? Or had what made you decide to get a carbon fiber one?
I wanted a nicely constructed 5-string cello. I have a serious wood cello for playing in orchestra music. I played around with taking a cheap 4-string cello, adding a 5th string, and never got all the dimensions worked out very well. And when I found a person who had a reputation of producing good instruments, who thought that he could produce a 5-string cello that would play well, it took me about 5 seconds to call him up and say, I want one.
So in other words, you really haven't seen wooden 5-string cellos.
I've never seen a 5-string. Yeah. Well, other than one that I kludged together myself and didn't work very well.
So you didn't go start marketing yourself as a creator of 5-string cellos, obviously.
Not yet.
Yeah. Well, let's have another tune. We're talking with participants in this Saturday's Central Illinois English Country Dancers 15th Annual Playford Ball. That's going to be at the Illini Union on the University of Illinois campus. We'll give you some times in just a moment, but what's our next tune?
This one's called Calstern Gardens. So you can imagine maybe even this was a garden dance. Who knows? Thank you.
So, Jonathan, did you get to do your research about the, was it Jane Eyre was the question?
Jane Austen.
Jane Austen.
Jane Austen. Many of these dances that we do, you will, if you go and see some of the Jane Austen movies that and or adaptations that have been on television.
WILL,
as a matter of fact. They use these tunes and these dances in those movies. However, you know, there's several caveats to that. Number one, most of the tunes and dances that they do use in those movies were not the ones they were using in Jane Austen's time. Jane Austen is very late 1700s and early 1800s. Most of these dances and tunes, at least the ones that are old ones and not modern compositions, were from the 1600s and early 1700s. So it's like saying that at a modern day function of, say, of, you know, in New York City or something like that, they'd be doing a dance from the late 1800s. Well, they wouldn't be. Not to say that nobody ever does those things, but, you know, they wouldn't be the popular thing to do. But they sound really good. They're really great tunes, and the dances that go with them look really good, so they use them. And the people who go to see the movies, they don't know the difference. So they don't
well, know. I mean, is any idea why they didn't just choose music of the time?
That I don't know. Probably the reason they didn't choose dances from the time, you know, the authentic dances from Jane Austen's time are very different and probably wouldn't look as elegant as, you know, they're trying to set a tone in the show.
In the movies, in fact,
yeah.
There's a lot of the dialogue among the characters
right. During the dance.
Now,
of course, sometimes
the dances move slow.
You know, sometimes
the
dance may not be an actual dance. They just have, okay, we're going to have the people move around like this while the music is playing. There's been plenty of times I've seen some of those where you'll see they're doing a dance. You say, oh, that's such and such a dance. But the tune is a different tune. there's not necessarily authenticity in those dances, but they're not worrying about that too much.
Well, how do you know what tune goes with which dance?
Well, once again, as I said, in Playford's book, he wrote out that, you know, here's the dance instructions, the figures, and here's the tune that goes with
it. Oh, it is all in there, right. I guess and, he did say that.
And after he wrote his, after he published his book and the subsequent editions, a lot of other people did the same. There were a whole bunch of books that came out in the 1700s with, you know, 24 dances for the year 1793 or whatever it was. They'd have dance instructions and tune.
Well, who's to say people didn't, in the actual event of the dance, they didn't just mix them up?
Well, I guess we don't know that.
No,
that's
we
a good
don't.
Point.
So,
and
see?
There's no video. No video
that was a
tape.
Long time ago.
And in fact, by Jane Austen's time, in the early 1800s, they were less tied music and dance together. And there was at least one popular activity at that time, which, you know, there people have written about, people of the time wrote about, you know, things they did at the ball, where the number one woman, the woman who was in the, who's the partner of the, in the first couple, she gets to choose the figures. The band has selected some tune they're going to play, and the woman decides we're going to do these figures. And she just makes up the dance on the fly. I'm sure it was a skill that required some ability.
And she knew what tune was going to be played?
Maybe not.
What if they didn't work together?
Well, then it wouldn't have been so good. And I don't know how, whether that was more of a curiosity that they did, you know, sort of a fun thing, let's try this. I also read once about some, like, playing cards with dance figures on them. And what you'd do is you'd deal out several cards, and here's the dance we're going to do. And
according to the luck of the draw,
yeah,
fairly literally
so
in that case.
I can imagine that a lot of those wouldn't work really well, but maybe there was some way that they, you know, they were allowed to rearrange them or do something to, so that they would work.
Well, maybe if they didn't work, that was half the fun.
Yeah.
Watching people stumble all over themselves.
Jonathan, how about some of your research down with the New Harmony? New Harmony.
Well, that's a
stuff, which is
that's another. There's a town over in Indiana called New Harmony. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, there were two utopian communities that were found, one that founded the town and then another one that moved in the 1820s. And the later one, they left behind some papers which included some instructions in music for dances. So we've done a few of those at our balls.
And since we just have a few minutes left, we better go over the schedule for Saturday for the Playford Ball with the Central Illinois English Country Dancers. You're starting with a warm-up session?
Well, we trying to have a period where, I mean, many of the people who come have come to many dances in the past. And the dances we're doing this, you know, on Saturday are ones that we've done several times in the last several months. So people who've been coming to the dances will be at least familiar with them. But we try and be open to anybody who wants to come. And so if somebody comes who has not been to the previous few dances, we're going to go over some of the figures for the dances we're going to do that evening. Plus, there's always a few new people. You know, somebody will bring their friend and who's never done English country dancing before. So we go over some of the basics of English country dance and how it works, and then some of the figures for the dances we're doing that evening. It's just sort of a get everybody, you know, warmed up, really.
So that's at 7 o'clock, and the ball itself starts at 8 and goes to about
11.
11 o'clock.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of dancing.
Yeah.
Is there food?
We do have refreshments at the break, yeah.
And you do call all the dances.
And all the dances will be taught and prompted as, you know, while the music plays as needed. So it is, in theory, possible for somebody who's never done it before to come and just join in.
And even skip the warm-up session if they want.
In theory, although I certainly, if you've never done it before, I'd certainly recommend coming to the warm-up.
A lot of people dress up in nice evening gowns and things, or this is your chance to wear Elizabethan Renaissance up to Civil War.
Yeah.
Any period costumes you like. Sometimes the colonial period is probably the most popular with our group. And so a good time to wear your fancy dress costume.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And are there, you know, I forgot to look. Are there photos up on your website from previous dances?
There are a few. I think we have a link to some some pictures someplace.
Well, you can check it out at Central Illinois ECD for Central Illinois English Country Dancers. org. The Playford Ball is at the Illini Student Union on the University of Illinois campus, room 314. Is that is the ballroom, right?
No, this is
not.
The ballroom's on the second floor.
Right.
This is on the third floor.
But a nice space.
It's
for a
nice dance. Space for a dance. It really is.
On West Green Street in Urbana, and we have with us Jonathan Severe, John Hansen. Jonathan, you're one of the callers?
Mm-hmm, yes.
John, do you do any of the calling, or you just dance?
No, I'm one of the dancers, one of the regulars about everywhere.
And three of the members of the Flatland Consort, who are the official band for the Playford Ball, Kelly McQueen, Tom Anderson, and Richard Engelbrecht, I can't say your name, Engelbrecht Wiggins. I don't know why I'm having trouble with that. I did it fine when
you
spelled it out for me. Let's go out with one more tune. What shall it be?
This is Gathering Peas Cods. It's got one place in the B section where the dancers actually clap twice. Maybe these guys can remember.
What did you say the name is?
Gathering Peas Cods.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
They're out in the country. And
they're
gathering
peas cods.
Yeah.
This may be one of those ones where the people were imagining themselves being country folk. Or this could actually be a country dance that was then, you know, brought into the city.
Yes, or they may really have no idea what, they really have, may have had no idea what they were talking about, in other words.
Must have meant something to them at
okay,
some point.
Okay, well, we hope so.
This wasn't Playford's original collection.
Yeah.
It was?
It was, yes.
It was, okay.
Dated 1651.
Wow, this is some old music here on Live and Local in 2010. Thank you. And those were members of the Flatland Consort who will be playing along with their other band members at the Playford Ball tomorrow in Urbana. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. On tomorrow's show, we'll have members of the station, a celebration company at the Station Theater in Urbana, who are about to open a comedy by Steve Martin in Urbana. And also, we'll talk about the Peoria Bach Festival on tomorrow's show from 12 to 1. Today's show is supported by the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting features Italian wines with Marco Ferlin of Ferlin Wines, available to answer questions. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. It's going to be partly sunny this afternoon, scattered showers and thunderstorms, a high of 82. We're currently at 77. This is WYLL-FM and HD Urbana, operating translators W293 AF Danville and W266 AF Urbana.